Hi, and welcome to Prosody, 90.5 FM's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Nancy Kirkwood, guest host of Prosody, and my guest today is Kent Nelson. His novels include Language in the Blood and The Land That Moves, The Land That Stands Still. His short fiction has been included in the Best American Stories, O. Henry, and his most recent book of short stories is The Spirit Bird, winner of the Drew Hines Literature Prize. Welcome to Prosody.
Thank you.
Could you start us out with a little reading?
I'd be glad to. This is a story toward the end of the book called, the beginning of the story, called The Beautiful Light. The economic slowdown caused by George W. Bush's arrogance, incompetence, and malfeasance threw Glenna Wolski's work schedule at Olson Saab into turmoil. People weren't buying cars, but they weren't maintaining the ones they had either. And Randy, the service manager, had let two mechanics go and restructured the other's time. Fred and Alvin liked four-day weeks. Jeff wanted overtime. Latrell and Leviticus preferred eight-hour days with a half hour for lunch. Larry and Glenna didn't care. According to Randy's estimate of customer satisfaction and employee efficiency, Larry was the best service technician. But Glenna was up there close, which, as the only woman, gave her bargaining power if she cared to use it. But she'd had other things on her mind. Her parents had died within 4 months of each other, her mother in a bicycle accident in May and her father of grief in September. And over the winter in Seattle, it had rained 72 days out of 100. She worried certainty in her hours might lead to boredom and further grieving, so she didn't know what to ask for. She was in Randy's office and ran a teaser comb through her frizz. "What about sporadic days?" she said. "You know, here and there, now and then, every once in a while." "You mean come in when you want?" Randy asked. "Take off when I want," Glenna said, "maybe one day a week." "I'm willing to work with you," Randy said, "but I need to plan." "Plan for randomness," Glenna said. "I will too." She'd worked at Olson's on Aurora for 4 years, lived in a one-bedroom in Eastlake, not far from I-5. A high school friend, Vicky, lived two floors above. In the neighborhood, Mr. Kang, the grocer, knew Glenna liked halibut, broccoli, and red leaf lettuce, that she drank 1% milk, mango juice, and occasionally Dr. Pepper, that her apartment had plumbing issues because every few weeks she'd bought Drano. Janet, the counterperson at Been There, knew her because every day on her way to work, Glenna ordered a regular and a cranberry muffin. Her check from Olson's was deposited automatically at Wells Fargo, and the tellers knew her because she came in Mondays and drew out cash. Her father had told her using cash made it harder to spend. Mostly Glenna hung out with Jimmer, though she didn't consider Jimmer a boyfriend. They'd met standing in parallel lines at Been There. Jimmer was tall and lanky and had on jeans, a rust-colored pullover, and a black knit cap. That day he was going to take his driver's test. "Aren't you a little old?" Glenna had asked. "When I was 12, I drove on the farm," Jimmer said, "but I never got a license. Is 27 old?" "Why bother now?" Glenna asked. "My mother's eyesight is wasted and she needs me to run errands in her Dodge." "So you live with your mother?" "No, I have an apartment in the university district. What about you?" "I'm a service tech at Olson Saab. Dodges are crap cars." "I'm not responsible for my mother's lack of taste. What do you think I do?" Glenna looked at him. He had blue eyes, teeth that had been fixed, a shock of fresh tweed sticking out from his cap. For a young man, his face was weathered, and he had creases around his eyes from looking into glare. "What's your name?" she asked. "Jimmer Zimmer," he said. "James, really, but you can't escape a nickname." "You're a fisherman," she said, "maybe a river runner or a fugitive from justice." "I'm a chef," he said. "I grew up on a farm near Cedro Woolley, but my father had liver problems, so he sold the farm machines and moved to Green Lake. He died, but my mother still lives there." Green Lake is fancy-dancy. "The combines, windrowers, and tractors were worth a lot. My parents kept the land but bought a house here." "Last year, my parents died within 4 months of each other," Glenna said. They arrived at the counter at the same time, and each of them ordered a large regular and a cranberry muffin, Jimmer said. He called her that afternoon at Olson's and told her he'd pass his driving test and asked if she wanted to go sea kayaking. Jimmer was not a chef, but a sous chef in training at St. Pierre's downtown. He dropped out of UW, but was good-natured but not too savvy about cars and loved the outdoors. They made a list of things to do together when the rain stopped: climb Mount Rainier, paddle from La Push to Lake Ozette, run the Seattle Marathon. Glennon wanted to swim the Strait of Juan de Fuca. I'd have to learn to swim, Jemmer said. Go outside, said Glennon. You can learn in the street. The rain didn't stop. Seattle's usual was 40 inches a year, but that winter the papers wrote stories about it and people made the usual jokes about building arks and carrying life preservers to work. Glennon and Jemmer made love more often. Glennon liked sex well enough, though not always for the pleasure. Since her parents' death, she'd felt weightless and lost, and being held down by another body made her feel secure, as if she were going nowhere. For several weeks, it rained on her random days off, and she didn't know what to do with herself. It was cold. Jemmer was working. The only friend around was Vicky, who'd been laid off from the Gap and was taking unemployment. I'm thinking of moving, Vicky said. California's too expensive, but maybe Hawaii. I know that's more expensive, but at least it's an island. It's several islands, Glennon said. She was standing at Vicky's window watching the rain fall between their apartment buildings and the next one over. Todd's on the big island, Vicky said. He says he can get me work in a hotel in Kona. Being a maid? At least I'd be there instead of here. Is that a philosophy? Do you have a philosophy? I have a job, Glennon said. I don't need a philosophy. Excuse me, but I don't see your life as an example. It isn't yet, Glennon said. I'm working on it. And this conversation isn't helping. I need some air. Glennon went downstairs, put on her orange poncho, and walked up the hill to East Lake. Rain obscured her perspective of the street. The buildings in both directions faded into gray. But she saw a bus coming from the south. She crossed the street and, without looking at the destination, got on it. It was a little after 11 a.m. Not many people were riding the bus at that hour, 8 or 9 lonely souls, nor in the rain were many people out on the sidewalks. The bus passed fast food franchises, apartment buildings, shops, a mattress outlet. At a hardware store, Glennon saw a woman in a maroon beret standing under the awning holding an umbrella that had been blown apart. She must have been a tourist. No one in Seattle carried an umbrella. And her expression was anguished, as if a terrible catastrophe had befallen her. Glennon pulled the cord for the next stop and got off the bus at the middle door. She doubled back, and when she reached the hardware store, the woman in the street was getting into a Chevy Nova. Glennon stood under the awning, pondered being unable to help, and wept. The rain let up a bit, and she walked along the shops, looking in windows. At a pet store, she saw colorful lovebirds and parakeets, several turtles, a gray cat. Farther on was a sushi bar with Japanese words on the glass, then a used bookstore and a shop for big sizes. At Green Lake, a mist hung in the trees and water dripped from the eaves. The lake held the aftermath of long rain, a hesitant, vulnerable sheen, as if it were waiting, though a lake couldn't wait for anything. A few people walked on the path, some with dogs on leashes, a man with a pet ferret, a woman with a lovebird on her shoulder. A woman was talking aloud to herself, strolled past. Glennon had no idea what to make of this spectacle of people with their differing gaits, expressions, clothes, languages. One Asian man was running backward across the grass, and a homeless couple was sheltered under a piece of cardboard.
Thank you. That's from your new book, The Spirit Bird, that won the Drew Hines Prize. And it's towards the end. I was wondering if you could talk with us a bit about when you were putting this together, sort of choosing the stories and what threads go through the whole book.
That's an interesting question because when we were talking about the cover, I suggested we find something that represented the mood of the book as a whole. And they said, well, what is the mood of the whole? And I didn't really, wasn't able to put any mood together. There's a story in here about a man turning into a donkey. There are several serious stories, set in a variety of places. So there isn't really a geographical theme either. I think there are 14 stories and 10 of them set in different places. 5 of the 14 stories are from the point of view of women. So it's a pretty disparate group of mm-hmm. pieces. And I'm not sure how I ended up with this particular order in the book.
Really?
Well, I liked the first story is called Alba. It's set in Hatch, New Mexico, and
yes.
It was in the Atlantic, so that was a pretty easy one to put in the first position. And the Spirit Bird, which is the title story, was in the Best of the West and won a couple prizes. So that seemed like an easy story to be number two, is, you know, because they're strong. And the only story that isn't published in a magazine is the last one, which is called My Crazy Father. And it's a story told from the point of view of my daughter about me.
Oh, my gosh. That's great. Well, then when you were writing these stories, did some come easy and then some were much harder? What's your favorite of the stories?
Oh, I don't know, but they have a favorite. I don't know that any story is easy to write, because I don't start with an idea. I start with just a character in a place. Mm-hmm. And so I don't know what's going to happen beyond the first page. And it takes me probably 2 or 3, 4 days to get through the first page. I write it over and over on a typewriter, and I like to hear the rhythms of the sentences as I add things. And then when I get to a certain point where I can't read all the crossings out, I type it over again. So I get to hear the language as the story progresses. And by the time I finish the first page, usually I know at least a little bit more about the character and what the next few pages might be like.
So there's a certain rhythm to you pick up as you go on. With a short story, it's, you know, it's short. But the end always has such impact that at what point do you start to just feel the ending, or do you figure it out and then try to construct?
Well, that's the joy of discovery.
Yeah.
You don't know how the story is going to end. You know, you at some point you have to deliver on all the things you've developed as you go along. But as, for example, in The Spirit Bird, I didn't know that there was going to be... I knew that the characters were going to go up on this sacred mountain, but I didn't know what was going to happen when they got up there. And somehow it materializes, is all I can say.
Yeah, it does, doesn't it? that's a great story. I also wanted to know if you could talk a little bit about, you also have two novels, and but you've written quite a lot of short story. And what are the differences? What are the things you enjoy about the short story?
I've written about 192 stories, of which 137 have been published so far. It's a manageable length, mm-hmm. and it's rewarding, because it doesn't require the stamina that a novel does. But novels are exciting because you can do much more and be a little more relaxed when you're working on them. It doesn't have to be quite so intense every moment. In fact, it shouldn't be. Mm-hmm. But stories I work in a little shed behind my house with no internet and no phone. Of course, you always have a cell phone. But I like the intensity. I like getting up every morning. It's the first thing I'd go do is make coffee and get out to my little place. And, if I get in 4 hours in the morning or even in a day, that's plenty of work.
Could you read a little bit more for us?
Sure. Yeah. I'll try the beginning of The Spirit Bird, which is the title story. The turboprop king air descends from the clouds and cants low over the sea around the snowy block of Suvuakuk Mountain, the sacred place, and there's a town of gamble, lines of shacks strung out on a stark gravel bar with the lake behind, still frozen at the end of May. Some of the shacks have red roofs, some blue, some shiny tin, and each house has a four-wheeler beside it. There are no trees. I see only one large building, the aluminum-sided school at the edge of town toward the mountain, but otherwise no brick post office, no granite courthouse, no white-painted town hall, no center. The plane circles the point where offshore ice stretches away into the clouds 40 miles to Siberia and makes for the runway between the ocean's shoreline and the frozen lake. It's mid-afternoon, but time doesn't matter here, because this far north, it's daylight forever. On the ground, the eight of us birders, strangers to one another, except for a mother and her college-aged son, are ferried by ATV to the hotel, such as it is, a modular structure with 10 rooms along one hallway, a kitchen in the lobby, and a room for eating and watching television. I'm in number 5 with Janet Moreland, a 40-year-old widow from Minneapolis, and I unpack my sweat clothes, heavy socks, slippers. I didn't bring makeup or my hair dryer. And then we assemble in the TV room and are reminded of the parameters of our visit. We have 5-day permits to be on the road around the lake and in the boneyards and along the shore to the northwest point. If we want to search the tundra or the mountain, if we want to look for the Eurasian dotterel, we'll need a native guide. No alcohol is allowed, no noise in the hotel after 11 p.m. We'll monitor channel 6.1 on our two-way radios. As part of the package, our group has rented 5 ATVs, and whether or not we stay with our guides, Heather and Larry, or go off on our own is up to us. But we should pace ourselves. The days of long light can be wearying. Get some sleep. Most birds are not one-minute wonders. They stay a day or two. Within an hour, we're dressed in parkas and wind pants and are out with the guides in the near boneyard searching for thrushes blown off course from Asia, sandpipers and plovers that breed in the far north, pipits, bluethroats, buntings, not one of which my friends in New Hampshire would ever have heard of. The boneyard is a dug-up expanse of what looks like a battlefield, holes 10 feet deep, some with water or ice in the bottom, bones strewn everywhere. In decades and centuries past, the Yupiks buried the corpses of seals and walruses near the town. In the last 50 years, as walruses diminished and ivory carving became sought after, the walrus tusks had a new value and the digging began. Birds hunker down in these holes out of the wind. We walk through stealthily in as much of a line as we can, Janet Moreland on my left and the college kid Eric on my right. Heather calls out red poles, Lapland longspurs, snow bunnings, all common birds here. Janet is a serious lister and eager for a brambling or an eyebrowed thrush. She has on a black parka with a hood and holds her Zeiss binoculars with both hands. I imagine her a store manager setting up quotas for the sales force or maybe an accountant. The boy, too, has all the gear, blue knit cap pulled low, gloves, red windbreaker, Swarovski glasses, but he's not looking as the rest of us are. He pauses and stares out beyond the shacks to the beach where, following his gaze, I see seal meat drying on racks and the skeleton of a whale. On his face is an expression of wonder, as if he were fleshing the bones of the whale and seeing it alive. You're not a birder, I ask him. My mother made me come, he says, from Houston, good birding territory. I know a little, he says. I've done High Island and Big Bend and the Lower Valley. My mother takes me to corroborate what she sees. But you're not a lister. I know everyone else is. How many do you have? 716 in North America. What would you be doing otherwise? I mean, at home. Screwing around, he says. Literally or figuratively? He smiles as if surprised by the intrusive familiarity of the question from someone my age. What would you be doing? He asks. I'm a professor from New Hampshire, I say. I'd be reading. He looks past the shacks again. How do they kill the whales? He asks, do they use rifles or spears? They ride ATVs and snowmobiles, I say. I suppose they use rifles. He ponders this. His face bares into the wind and longish hair spills from beneath his knit cap. His eyes are brown, his chin bristly. He reminds me of my own son I never had, an invisible son, one I imagine. Then a bluethroat appears in a hole in front of us. It hops to the edge and struts among the bones, smaller than a robin, rusty tail. Bluethroat, Janet calls out, and the line of birders breaks and runs toward the bird.
Thank you. I know there's always that saying of write what you know, and you know birds.
I do know birds.
I did read that. And I don't know that it's a thread, but certainly there are birds popping up through every story.
Not everyone, but a lot of them. I noticed that too.
Yeah.
The characters have ties to birds or know about birds or know a little bit about birds so that they can be mentioned. I started birding when I was 10 years old, and you kind of learned it because it wasn't something you got from school. And it's been a great hobby for a writer because it makes you observe things. It leads you far afield. I've been to Alaska, where this story takes place, Newfoundland, Costa Rica, Ecuador, New Zealand, a lot of places where just you would go for birds, but also in places you would never go without birds. This spring, for example, I went to Attu Island, which is the last Aleutian island. It's 1,500 miles from Anchorage. You had to take a flight about two-thirds of the way down to a little airport and then go 400 miles on a boat to get there. It was an amazing trip.
And what birds did you find there?
Well, not as many birds as I'd hoped, but albatrosses on the way down, rustic bunting, sixth record in North America of a certain kind of snipe. It was a fun group. But also Attu is a battleground in World War II. It's the only battle fought on American soil. So it was interesting from that point of view. There were a lot of war detritus, barrels, rusted tanks, all sorts of weird things that were still there.
Do you ever write when you're on those trips?
Always. I revised a whole novel when I was on the boat.
I would imagine it's pretty inspirational for someone. You have like 700. You're a lister. I don't know anything about
765.
Birds, 765, to be exact.
To be exact, right.
So when this book, when you got the Drew Hines Award, were you surprised?
Of course I was surprised.
Well, do have a big history and short story.
Nevertheless, when Ed Ochester called me, I knew exactly who he was and why he'd called, and I was thrilled. My girlfriend and a friend of hers were sitting on the couch, and when I answered the phone, and they stopped and listened to the whole conversation. It was pretty exciting.
Well, we're glad you're here. Could you read just a few minutes more? Do you have a?
Sure. This is from Alba, which is the lead story, and it's about a 19-year-old kid, 20-year-old kid who has come across from Mexico illegally, and he's delivering movies into a rural town on his moped, and so that's his job in the States that he's worked out. He's pretty self-motivated, but this little part is taken from back in Mexico, and it's sort of part of the backstory. At the end of his days in Ricardo Flores, Ultimo had a girlfriend, Alba, 3 years older, a friend of Marta's, whom his mother had gone to help. Alba was devout and shy, and she went to mass every day with her mother. She wasn't one of her sister's friends who'd shown him what pleasure was, and he knew better than to coax her or try to kiss her. Instead, he asked to see her naked body. "Once," he said, "I want to remember you when I'm gone." "You can remember being with my clothes on," she said. "I promise I won't touch you. You will look at me with lust. That's a sin." "I might look at you with lust," Ultimo said. "That will be my problem, not yours." "Why would you ask this," she said, "when you know I cannot do such a thing?" "There's no cause for a question." The next day, as they walked outside the village, Ultimo asked again. "I've already answered you," Alba said. "You might have changed your mind," Ultimo said. "You might have decided there could be no harm in it because I will go to the States. When are you going?" "Soon," Ultimo said, "when my mother comes back from Buenaventura." "In any case, where do you think we should do such a thing? Lorena and Abuelita are at your house and my mother is at mine." "In the church," Ultimo said. "There's a room behind the altar where we used to wait before Mass. No one is there in the afternoon." She laughed. You're as crazy as your sister." "Only once," Ultimo said. "I want to walk all the way around you. When I'm in the States, I will remember clearly your whole body." "Without touching," Alba said. "Yes, it won't happen." A week passed. Ultimo tended Lorena, who was seeing the Virgin Mary in the clouds. He humored her, sang to her, told her she would live to be 103 years old. They threw stones into the ravine. Ultimo read her stories from a magazine. Their mother returned, grieving for a lost granddaughter. "It was God's will," she said. "The child was never well, but did it have to die?" God's will, Ultimo said. What is that? A few days later, Ultimo filled two plastic bottles with water and loaded his backpack with food that wouldn't spoil, peanut butter, bread, cans of stew, and said goodbye to Alba at the tienda where she worked. I'm leaving tomorrow before daylight, he said. I'm going alone so I won't get caught. I promise I'll write. How will you find your way? I am destined for great things, Ultimo said. I've changed my mind, Alba said. I will do what you asked. Ultimo said nothing. At 2 o'clock, I have a break, Alba said. I'll meet you at the church. Promise, he asked. At 2 o'clock that afternoon, Alba appeared at the church as she said she would. The room Ultimo remembered was behind the altar, though he had forgotten how barren and simple it was. There was only one square window high up in the wall, and light fanned down under the plaster of the wall opposite. You have to turn around, Alba said. Ultimo turned around and stared up at the light. He heard the swishing of clothes, a dress fall to the floor, then quiet. Now, Alba said. He turned back slowly and saw her body, her small dark-tipped breasts, her long black hair over one shoulder. She did not hide herself with her hands, but lowered her eyes. He was aware of her face, the expression of chasteness, but of joy, too, as if she were both ashamed and glad of the moment. Ultimo walked all the way around her so that, for a few seconds, his shadow fell across her body, and then her body returned to light.
Thanks. That's a beautiful story. I really love that one.
Thanks.
It ended very hopefully. I was wondering, you had earlier said that, mentioned that the stories take place in, you know, from Alaska to the East Coast. And I was wondering, also the way that it's written, place is very important to you, and you write it well.
Well, and, thanks.
Yeah.
It is very important.
And have you traveled extensively? What motivates you to have such different
Well, that's why
settings.
Birding is so great, because
yeah.
I've spent a lot of time in South Texas. I've spent a lot of time in Florida and then in New England and California. I mean, that's what birding does. It leads you to places you wouldn't go, and each of those places can become a background for a story.
I really thank you for coming and congratulate you on winning the Drew Hines
Prize. Thanks
very
much.
The Writing of Kent Nelson. Thank you so much for being here. You've been listening to Prosody, a weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a biweekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the arts entertainment news weekly published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty and Ellen Wadey. Our sound engineers are Michelle Stoner and Lisa Alexander. Please tune in Saturday mornings at 6:30 for Prosody 90.5 FM.